This is the current federal tax developments for the week of September the 25th, 2017, brought to you by the Lascalzo Institute, a Kaplan company, and by your state society of CPAs. This week, we've got a few developments taking place. We're going to take a look at the further expansion of Hurricane Irma relief. We'll talk about a case where a volunteer attorney found that no good deed goes unpunished as he gets involved in a conflict of interest situation with his clients. We'll talk about a payment for issues involved in a foreclosure ended up creating taxable income for the taxpayer. We'll talk about the IRS's pilot program to issue private letter rulings on more issues that arise with de-reorganizations and Section 355 than the IRS would previously issue rulings on. And we'll talk about proposed regulations to implement a provision in the PATH Act that would allow employee W-2s to have truncated Social Security numbers on them. Well, we're coming up and we're now going to be approaching this week the due date for the trust returns, so we're in that whole run time. But maybe have a little bit of time this week to come out and take a look at some courses. I'm going to remind you that coming up on the 28th and 29th of this week, Thursday and Friday, Don Cochran is going to be in Manhattan giving first on the 28th a current federal tax developments course, and then on the 29th, real estate partnerships, get in, get out, get taxed. Those courses will be both held at the New York Society of CPAs facility in Manhattan, and they'll be webcast by the New York Society of CPAs. If you want to sign up for those courses, go to cpe.nysscpa.org. I, on Thursday, will be in the Cincinnati area, in Fairfield, actually, a little bit north of Cincinnati, and I'll be talking about the multi-state taxation of businesses. We'll talk about how that goes. As you know, we've had a lot of developments in that area over the past few weeks, and I'll be talking about the things that happened in all of those various developments we've had with the multi-state taxation this year, especially in the area of sales taxes at that course. Don will also be presenting that course in South Dakota in early October, along with a course on assisting the survivors of the decedent's estate. Those courses will be October 4th for the estate-based course and October 5th for the multi-state taxation of businesses course. Those courses will be held in Rapid City, South Dakota. You can register for those courses at www.sdcpa.org. Well, let's take a look at what's going on this week. And as I noted to start, we are having a further expansion of the Irma hurricane relief. This time, it'll be an Internal Revenue Service news release, IR 2017-156, that was issued on the 19th. This expands the Irma relief for late filing and late deposits to cover the entire state of Georgia for those affected by Hurricane Irma. As you may recall, after going through Florida, it headed up north through the state of Georgia. The IRS has now decided that that relief can apply there. It is effective back to September 7th. So although it took a while to get it out, IRS now has that relief expanded. As is true with the relief for Harvey and the relief that was given to residents of Florida and Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands under Hurricane Irma, in this case, any filing deadline that occurred after September 7th, but before January 31st, 2018, that particular deadline will now become January 31st, 2018. As the IRS told us back at the very beginning in the Harvey relief, that relief means that something like the October 15th due date for filing an individual tax return on the second extension, that's pushed back to January 31st. But as the service notes, that does not mean that interest and penalties will be suspended. You won't have a failure to file penalty, that won't be triggered, but a failure to pay penalty and interest will continue to run during that period because, as the notice points out, all of that was supposed to have been paid up back last April. And in essence, the way the IRS has interpreted this from rulings we had earlier this year we discussed is that, you know, the problem was that you didn't do it back then. That wasn't prevented by the hurricane. So those interest and penalties would continue to run. So you do need to be aware of that, even though you'll get to January 31st to do everything else, the interest and the failure to pay penalty would continue to run. Similarly, the payroll tax deposit dates get pushed back 15 days. Now, at this point, we're already past that 15-day period because it'd be 15 days after the 7th, and we're sitting here on Monday. If you're listening to this on Monday, our official release date, we're sitting here a bit after that of the 25th, but it was a 15-day delay. So any deposits due from September 7th through the 22nd, if they're made on the 22nd and you are in the affected area, those deposits are considered timely. Now we'll have to take a look, see what else starts coming. Of course, we just had another hurricane hit Puerto Rico. So things are getting interesting here with the hurricanes this year. So we may not be done with getting this sort of relief as all of these storms keep piling up. But for right now, it appears that this is where we're going. We now have the Harvey and Irma ones. Probably those relief items are now done. We'll just have to see if other hurricane relief issues come up as we go through what's been so far a rather difficult hurricane season. Next up, we're going to take the court case of Gebman versus Commissioner. This is Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2017-184. This case was released on, the opinion was released on the 18th of September. And this case kind of proves that no good deed ever goes unpunished. What happened here was that an attorney here who's going to be involved in this, he was down at the tax court. There was a program that was being put on at the tax court, or was being put on by a group of attorneys in the New York City area. And Mr. Ritter went down there as a volunteer attorney who was going to be listening to, was going to basically hear, you know, offer his services to taxpayers that showed up for their tax court case who didn't have representation. And he did that actually as the New York County Lawyers Association was the organization he was working for. So this Mr. Gebman came up, and Mr. Gebman actually arrived a bit late for court because they couldn't find parking. Can't imagine that would ever be a problem in Manhattan. So his wife was trying to park the car at that point. He was there. The court denied his request to have the hearing pushed back to a later date. Probably his parking problems would have still been the same that day. But they did allow him to wait till the afternoon, and they offered him the chance to speak with one of the attorneys who was present to, you know, help consult with taxpayers who were going to be representing themselves. So Mr. Gebman took advantage of that. He and the attorney had a discussion, which from the opinion, it's not clear. He wanted to have a discussion, he said, with his wife in the room, but it's not, the opinion didn't tell us totally if that actually happened. We do know that he talked with, Mr. Gebman talked with the attorney. We don't know if Mrs. Gebman did. But in any event, during that meeting, the attorney apparently listened to his defense, determined that he didn't really have a defense. Apparently, he was making what is implied in this case to be the traditional tax protester type complaints about why it's unfair, why his tax basically wasn't going to work. So the attorney convinced him that, in fact, you know, he wasn't going to carry this and that there would be a big liability which could put his wife at risk. And he didn't want to harm his wife. So he agreed that what they'd do is that they would go in and he would admit to the tax liability. And then he would allow Mrs. Gebman to claim an innocent spouse relief so that she would be off the hook, hopefully for the taxes. Now, of course, he'd be due. Now, whenever you get innocent spouse relief and you're representing the couple, it is a really dicey situation to avoid a conflict of interest problem. Because obviously your advice has the problem here that to the extent we succeed in getting relief for Mrs. Gebman, it means that Mr. Gebman is going to be liable for the whole thing, which of course goes against the interest of the taxpayer. It's a little difficult. But in any event, it appeared though that Mr. Gebman had kind of agreed on this. And the attorney tried to make it in court that he was representing Mrs. Gebman only. But he did show up, and, you know, when the taxpayer was asked about did he understand what he was, you know, did he really want to plead and say that he was giving in on all the assertions the IRS was making for his tax due, he said, yes, 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 he's going to do exactly what this gentleman, the attorney, advised them to do. Okay, great. Now comes the fun. A few days later, Mr. Gebman has a change of heart and actually files a petition with the tax court to try to get his admissions taken back so he could try the case. Now, also in the interim, the innocent spouse matter went forward a bit. And in that case, the problem was that a lot of the income was from an IRA distribution from Mrs. Gebman's IRA account. Obviously, that's normally a problem because innocent spouse relief doesn't really help to get you out of tax on your income. But Mrs. Gebman was going to claim that Mr. Gebman had taken it from her account by fraud, and so he should be liable. Now, he claimed to still be okay with this innocent spouse relief, but he wanted to take back his plea, and he also, or not plea, I should say, but he wanted to take back his admission, and he also, you know, wanted to contest the matter, and he would not sign a conflict waiver. Well, the tax court, when this came up, said, you know, we think there's a problem here. And they determined that here's your problem, Mr. Attorney. Now, the attorney tried to continue to represent her. He said, you know, basically one of the ideas was, well, Mr. Gebman still wants her protected, so I should still be able to do the instant spouse relief. And realistically, even though, yeah, it's all going to be due from him, realistically, he hasn't made income for years. He has no assets. So really, it's not going to harm him at all, you know, to have this liability. It'll be treated as not collectible by the service, and he'll never be harmed. The tax court didn't go along with that. First thing they said, even though you never officially appeared for Mr. Gebman in court, or, you know, you can't really claim you didn't ever represent him in some form. The court found that, in fact, he had been, at the very least, a potential client from whom the attorney had received information that now was a problem. He also found that he has clearly consulted with him in the court, and he seemed to believe that he was getting advice from the attorney. And finally, it pointed out that he had refused to sign the conflict waiver. You know, so regardless, and finally, the defense for Mrs. Gebman pushing forward her defense was going to essentially be a fraud, was going to admit that there was tax due, but was going to claim that the tax was due because it came out of her IRA account, and she admits it's not there anymore. It's going to say that, no, he took it out of there, you know, and he did that on his own, which, as the court said, would be going directly against his claim that it's not taxable at all. So he said there's no way it goes directly in conflict. So the court ruled that, in fact, the attorney either needed to get this situation resolved in some way so there was no longer a conflict, or needed to resign the case. What this tells us is, now, again, most people listening to this are not attorneys, and most of us are not going to be representing clients in court, but this does illustrate the complexities you can run into when you're representing husband and wife, and even the problem we run into that sometimes when it appears they've now agreed on a way to move forward, you know, that's going to quote unquote be fair, you still got to watch the conflict problems. You know, Mr. Gebman still, I assume, the way we heard in the court, was still thinking his wife needs protection. But the problem was that how, you know, what he continued to do made it impossible for this attorney to represent her and protect her when he already had information from Mr. Gebman. Just be careful and keep your eyes open. And you got to feel sorry for this attorney because, of course, he's not being paid for any of this, and he had to go through this entire mess. Next up, we're going to take a look at the case of Ritter versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2017-185. This one was issued on September 19th. This goes back to the whole real estate problems we had. Remember the real estate crash? This relates to that. What happened in this case was Mr. Ritter, he lost his home via foreclosure. Okay, this is in the real estate crash. His home, the bank came in, the bank took his home back. Now, the problem was, as you remember, there was a lot of discussion about robo-foreclosure and other issues where the bank seemed to have shortcut some of the requirements to file foreclosure petitions in many states. The bank in question here, which was Chase, eventually entered into a settlement after it was being investigated by the state agency, and agreed to establish a qualified settlement fund, and it would pay out to various parties that potentially had been harmed by what was described as the lenders' deficiencies, unsafe and unsound practices related to lending and foreclosures. And it was determined that, in this case, Mr. Ritter was going to receive $35,000. Now, the reason he would is because of the class of borrower he was in. The agreement made it clear that he did not have to show that there was any specific financial harm he had incurred, nor was it meant to reimburse him for any specific financial harm. Now, the bank, you know, the fund issued him a 1099 for other income for this amount of money. He did not report this on his return. Now, the court had to determine, was this taxable income? The court noted that generally, we have to look at why a payment's being made, what was the nature of a legal claim, in order to determine whether a payment received in settlement of that claim is considered to be income, reimbursement of an expense, considered to be, let's say, an additional sales proceeds could lead to capital gain. And in the case of a qualified settlement fund, you have to look at the terms and the conditions under which the payment's being made to that particular taxpayer. The court found in this case, because in fact the agreement said that he didn't have to demonstrate any financial harm, he didn't have to have incurred any financial harm, and this payment was not tied to any financial harm, that it wasn't reimbursing him for lost costs. It wasn't reimbursing him for lost equity in the home. Rather, by its terms, it was just income. Code Section 61 tells us broadly that income from any source is gross income. And generally, you have to find a way to determine that that amount is excluded somewhere if you're not going to pay tax on it. The taxpayer could not show a reason why it would not be counted as income. Therefore, the court concluded that this payment was taxable to Mr. Ritter as ordinary income. Next up, we're going to look at Revenue Procedure 2017-52, issued on the 21st of September. This deals with issues related to de-reorganizations and distributions of stock. There are a number of variants of de-reorgs, but in the case we're looking at here today, we're looking at a de-reorg where we're going to distribute stock of a subsidiary out to shareholders. It may have been a newly formed subsidiary. We're going to split the company up. So it's a way we do that. And so in this case, using 355 to get it out tax-free. Now, back in 2013, the IRS had issued a revenue procedure that strictly limited how much they would, you know, basically the conditions under which they would give a ruling of whether or not a particular item, you know, what they'd rule on for these types of transactions. Specifically, we limited the ruling to what they were considered a significant issue. And a significant issue is defined as an issue of law, the resolution of which is not essentially free from doubt, and that is germane to determining the tax consequences of the transaction. That greatly reduced how many things the service would rule upon in these areas. Now the IRS is saying, okay, having worked with that for a while, they're going to try expanding up what they'll rule on. And in this case, they will issue additional rulings beyond those that would meet the significant issues test. And they said to be covered by the ruling, it needs to be what they call a covered transaction. So it has to be intended to qualify under Section 368A1 Cap D and Section 355, or a distribution is intended to qualify under Section 355A and 355C. Now, the IRS will release these transactional rulings related to specific provisions of the law. And transactional ruling, they say here, may include the tax consequences of a covered transactions under the following sections: 312, 355, 357, 358, 361, 362B, 362E, 368A1 cap D, 368B, 1031A, 1223-1, and 1223-2, and the relevant consolidated return regulations. It goes on to say, though, after that, that the IRS may decline to rule on tax consequences under any provision of code regulations, or may decide that they could rule on other things related to this. So it's kind of broad. They've opened the door as to what they'll rule on, but they still have to agree to rule on it. They note that it does not change areas where the IRS specifically had a no ruling policy. And that includes letter rulings on the device prohibitions under 355A1 cap B and regulation 1.355-2D, the business purpose requirements found under regulation 1.355-2B, and whether a distribution is pursuant to a plan under section 355E. What you need to do, though, if you did a ruling this area, this particular revenue procedure tells you the steps you need to take and the information must be provided. Now, these sorts of rulings on these 355 and these D splitting up an entity transactions, they're significant because, you know, if it turns out that you didn't qualify, we end up with a taxable distribution to shareholders. That means recognizing gains inside the corporation and then the shareholders potentially having to recognize a gain as well on disposition of shares. So it's kind of bad if it doesn't work out right. This allows us to get a bit more comfort in areas that we weren't totally sure on, assuming we can get a ruling. Now, this program is only going to run for 18 months. At the end of that term, the IRS will evaluate the program to determine if it should be extended, terminated, or maybe extended and even expanded to cover more things. In any event, if you've got a client trying to go through this structure or trying to send out, you know, kind of split up a business, you might want to take a look at your options for potentially getting additional comfort from a letter ruling in areas beyond which we've currently been able to get it since 2013. Finally, we're going to talk about a proposed regulation, Reg-105004-16. This came out on September the 20th. And this deals with putting into place an ability for employers to print truncated Social Security numbers on their employees' W-2s. Congress, in passing the PATH Act at the end of 2015, removed the Internal Revenue Code requirement that a full Social Security number had to be printed on the employee's copies of W-2. Up until the PATH Act, there was no option under the law. The law said you could not put anything but a full social. Now, that's great, but that only got us partway solution. Because the regulation still provided, you know, all it says is now the IRS can tell us what we can put on there. And obviously, the IRS had not yet told us what we can put on there. The IRS has been considering this issue, and now they've issued proposed regulations that would allow for truncated taxpayer identification numbers. And if you actually start following this in the reg and read it, they actually, of course, give that the acronym of TTIN. So it's one of those things, you're looking for a TTIN, what they have there, that's considered your truncated number. Generally, a truncated number is allowed under Regulation 301.6109-4A. This has been allowed for 1099s for a while. And what you have to do is have an EIN in which the first five digits of a nine-digit number are replaced with X's or asterisks. So, long way of saying, the last four digits of the social or the last four digits of the employer identification number are shown on there along with placeholders for the number, for the digits that are blanked out. So, for instance, as they say, you could have a Social Security number that was XXX-XX-1234, or those could be asterisks. So, the IRS is proposing, now this is still just proposed regulations, but they are proposing to allow you to go to using the truncated form. And obviously, the reason we want to do that is because of concerns about identity theft. You know, those W-2s can be intercepted in the mail. And once they're intercepted, they could easily be misused. So there's a lot of reasons why we'd like to do that and like to have those truncated items going through the mail. Currently, that's not possible. This reg would change it. However, not going to change it for 2017. Why? Well, the IRS, when they were putting this together, got complaints from a lot of states. The states claim that they're not yet set up for processing for people that file paper returns and send in the paper W-2s. They wouldn't be able to process those returns without having the full employer with having the full Social Security number on the W-2. And they need another year to update their computer systems so they could process those paper returns without having access to the full Social Security number on the form W-2. So the IRS has agreed that this will not take effect for any W-2s issued before December 31st of 2018. What that means is the 2017 W-2s will still have full Social Security numbers on them for every employee. But beginning in 2018, the W-2s will go to having asterisk positions. Probably most employers will go to the truncated form, I would assume, once we get the option to go there. But in the interim, we're going to have to deal still with those full numbers. And again, probably safest if you can, you're distributing those to employees, to distribute them in person to the people in the building. But obviously, sometimes employees have left, they're no longer with us, and things get mailed. And of course, the bad news is our envelopes have to say important tax information. So not surprising that it's become a problem for identity thieves. Well, again, we're coming up now, and I realize you guys are probably now really gearing up to prepare your tax returns here for the deadlines, the trust deadline coming up at the 30th, right at the end of this month, actually the 1st of October. You know, what is it? Yeah, it's actually October 2nd. I have to remember where we all get here this year. So at least the Monday after September 30th, and then the individual income tax returns deadlines coming up in October. But after that, there's going to be lots of time when you guys are going to be picking up your continuing education. So we remind you to go check your state society calendars. Go check the offerings coming up here in October, November, December to get your continuing education. And we're looking forward to seeing you at those sessions. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of September the 25th. You can catch our updates during the week online at the currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com website. You can also download a PDF with the articles supporting this week's developments. Go to currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, click on the link that talks about the weekly updates, audio and video updates, and there on the link for today's presentation for the 25th of September, you're going to find a link that will get you the articles in PDF format. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. I also post on Twitter. My handle there is @edzollers. And at that location, I will post as things, I will tell you when we post new items to the Current Federal Tax Developments website. Also may post a couple of other things that may come up of interest that are tax related. So go ahead and follow us there. Well, until then, have fun this week getting your final trust put together and put to bed and getting ready to go after those individuals. And we'll look forward to seeing you next week as we talk about current federal tax developments.